Hello and welcome to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt.
How are you, Dan? Are you excited about finally to talk about a Brad Pitt film that, like, one of us actually likes?
I think both of us actually like this film.
Yeah, which is very unusual.
Well, so the name of the film is... So I'm Dan.
Oh, of course, I'm Joe.
Just so you can remember that reasonably... I think our voices are reasonably distinct. I don't think... I mean, who knows
if people will have... Leave a comment on your preferred social media to tell us how different our voices are.
Yeah, message us on Twitter or I think thebradpittcast@gmail.com. Actually, email us at thebradpittcast@gmail.com.
And if you do that, it's possible that you will be the first person to send an email to that address.
It would be quite an iconic moment to receive an email. We've only been receiving notifications about signing in on various devices so far. Anyway, the name of the film today is Cutting Class.
Cutting Class. It's the third film that we've done on this podcast. We did Ad Astra first, which is Brad Pitt's latest film. Then we went way back to the beginning and did his first film, The Dark Side of the Sun, which is an atrocity.
Well, interestingly, on the Wikipedia page currently of Cutting Class, it says it's his first starring role, which it is not.
No, because he stars in The Dark Side of the Sun.
Yeah.
But this, Cutting Class, is a film, it came out in 1989. Mm. I think maybe what they're referring to is Dark Side of the Sun. I don't think ever went to the cinema.
97, right? Yeah.
Is it 87?
I think it was filmed in 87. I think it came out in 97.
Imagine all of the things that you don't remember and your brain has, like, you have two dates in your head associated with the Dark Side of the Sun. It's true. Pushing out information.
Everything I remember about that film is is taking up space in my brain that could be taken up by empathy or... maths.
Yeah. It's also worth noting we will get to kind
of we're not gonna go relitigate The Dark Side of the Sun.
We in order to make our audio quality as good as it could possibly be, Dan and I are currently sitting in, I suppose you'd call it a fort.
It
feels like a fort. It's two chairs with a blanket over the top.
It's quite cozy.
Ida the dog is on the other side, who if you listen to the Ad Astra episode, you'll remember Ida, like, occasionally butting in with noises. She's now between a kind of a sheet. She's on the other side of it and extremely stressed about the fact that we're under here.
If this podcast ends with the sound of some kind of, like, industrial collapse and us saying, oh, fuck, it all mean that Ida has invaded the fort, which is not impossible.
To try and work out what we're doing. We're talking about Cutting Class, which is a 1989 slasher film. It's... Brad Pitt's, I guess it must be his first theatrically released, maybe that's what it's talking about. Dark Side of the Sun came out much later.
I'm sure it's a contested issue on the Wikipedia message boards.
I'm sure that there are people out there who are as committed to Brad Pitt as we are, who have debate regularly. It's also, so some people have listened to the podcast so far. Thank you so much for everyone who's listened to any of this nonsense. And someone messaged him, was like, I'm really excited. I love Brad Pitt. It's interesting that so far all you've done is talking about how much you hate the films that Brad Pitt is in and how you think he's a bad actor, which we talked about a lot in The Dark Side of the Sun.
We thought he was good in Ad Astra.
Certainly. I think he's great in Ad Astra.
He is great
in Ad Astra. In a deeply flawed film. Mm-hmm. So the exciting thing talking about Cutting Class is, I love this film. Dan?
I liked it. So I think it may become a theme of this podcast and is probably a theme of my friendship with Joe in general, is that a defining... Joe's taste in cinema hews towards cinema with which I am largely unfamiliar. Mm-hmm. And this, among those that genres, among the genres to which Joe has dedicated his life... ...is the slasher film, which I'm not against. I have no fundamental issues with the slasher film. I just haven't seen many or maybe any of them.
We were trying to work out what slasher films Dan had seen.
Is Cabin in the Woods a slasher film?
Well, it deconstructs the slasher. Yeah. Even that is not necessarily a slasher. So
I should not be co-hosting a movie podcast. I have some enormous gaps in my film knowledge.
Dan has... It's a good... Thank you for providing me with the opportunity to say this. Dan has the craziest DVD collection of any human being I've ever met. Dan has... three seasons of The Wire.
I think four of the five.
You're missing a season.
Yeah, I'm missing season two. I think I lent it to someone once.
He has Trumbo, the biopic about Dalton Trumbo, the screenwriter starring Bryan Cranston. Like, no one remembers that
I
film
haven't
exists.
Watched it yet.
He has The Front Runner, the Hugh Jackman political comedy. You have a breast on, right? You
have, I do
a
have
man
a breast on, yeah.
It's, I mean, I... I love Dan anyway.
I've got a bunch of Wes Anderson films.
You do! I love Dan, but seeing the DVD collection made that fondness in my heart grow so much deeper.
I think, look, it's a collection of... some of them I have bought. Some of them have been gifted to me. It's not a deliberately constructed collection. You can contrast it with my books.
True.
Which are also a bit haphazard, but there's a lot of them at least.
Well, yeah, I suppose you could make the argument that the books are the self that you want to project to the world, and the DVDs are the true self, the messy self.
I mean, I'll have to work through that with my therapist, but sure.
So, because we're talking about Cutting Class, which is a slasher film, I wanted to, as briefly as possible, with Dan hopefully like watching the clock to make sure that I stay true to my word, briefly give an overview of the slasher. So, as Dan says, like, I love horror movies. My ideal art form, I genuinely think, is 80s American slashers. They're like the horror film that I gravitate towards most. So to very briefly give an overview, because Cutting Class is 89.
Yeah.
So it's really on the tail end of an American enterprise that is like coming to an end by that stage. Mm. So people tend to talk about the first slasher being Halloween, which is the John Carpenter film in 1978, which Carpenter made that film for like less than $1 million, and it grossed over $100 million in 1978 money. So colossal success. And it...
Was that a surprise to everyone involved?
Absolutely. Carpenter really, I think, just thought that... Because it was one of Carpenter's first films. He'd made like a very student-y sci-fi film. And I think he just expected that he would be like... This would just be another attempt, another thing on the CV to get him a bigger gig. And instead it turned into this massive film. So much of a success, in fact, that a man called Sean S. Cunningham was sitting in the audience watching Halloween. He was like, saw the incredible success. He was like, I want some of that money. He went out and he took a full page ad in a paper saying that he had made the scariest film ever made. He hadn't written it. He hadn't shot a frame. He had no idea what it was about. All he knew was the title, which was Friday the 13th.
No way.
And that started the Friday the 13th franchise, which is, as far as I'm concerned, like the pinnacle of human achievement.
Joe wants me at some point to watch Friday the 13th Part 8.
Part 8, which... Jason Takes Manhattan, is better than Citizen Kane, definitely.
Joe's face is extraordinarily earnest right now.
I mean...
He's not joking.
Jason Takes Manhattan is like the Sistine Chapel. It's like such a pure piece of human construction that I'm awed every time I see it.
Mm.
So Cunningham makes the Friday the 13th movies and kicks off this boom. And I think what's really interesting is that what I love about slashes, in as tight and concise a sentence as I can make it, is that like slashes are purely exploitative. They're exploitative of the people that star in the films. They're also exploitative of the audience. They are, I think, the closest that cinema gets to like a circus act. They're like really like wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. Like everything you could possibly want. All this crazy shit. Nudity, sex, violence, drug use. Packed in very tightly with all of the unimportant stuff completely turned down. And just like ratcheted up to the very top. Which I think as a like final point, which is why I kind of brought up Halloween as people talking about the starting point. There's a film that comes out 4 years before Halloween called Black Christmas, which is also a five-star masterpiece. Not quite the Sistine Chapel, but like just like a couple of steps down. And Black Christmas is about a slasher terrorizing a sorority house. And Halloween is actually, for all the conversations it inspired about drug use on screen and nudity on screen and stuff like that, Black Christmas is the ultimate circus act film. Like nudity, high melodrama, violence, incredibly shocking, surreal images. And that, to me, Black Christmas is the film that Cutting Class is most riffing off. It's like the slasher ideal of, yeah, it's just like, you want fucking sex? Here's sex. You want violence? Here's violence.
So is it about the honesty of their exploitation? That they aren't pretending to be anything that they're not?
It's what draws me to horror, certainly. It's like, I was about to say something that sounds very arrogant. I was about to say I'm a person who thinks a lot. I don't even know if that's true.
I think it is true. I'll tell you, I can say Joe's a person who thinks a lot.
I'm a philosophy student, right? Like usually the things I come to in my work life tend to be extremely...
That was Ida breathing out if that was caught on mic. That was not me expressing my exhaustion with Joe's riffing on horror, which I'm enjoying quite a lot.
So, you know, in my academic life, I'm someone who like reads stuff that requires a lot of brain power. I think my love of horror comes from an exhaustion and a dislike almost of the way my brain works.
It's an oblivion.
It's such an oblivion. It's the transcendence of being slack-jawed in an image that's just come from a mind so demented or so desperate to get your money.
And attention, right?
And attention, which just creates something beautiful.
Which there may be, I think that I would say, I'm still, look, I have not settled on how I feel about Cutting Class, but I think there might be half a dozen of those images.
It's,
or moments, at least.
It's an extraordinarily constructed film.
It is, actually.
It's, so, so let's do...
Well, what's the overall plot of Cutting Class?
Sure.
The Precy.
It is a high school set, as the name implies.
Mm.
A high school...
A pun. We'll leave you to work out the nature of the pun.
A high school set, menage a trois, love triangle,
yep,
between Brad Pitt's Dwight, who is a jock. Dwight's a great
Dwight's
Brad
a
Pitt
perfect
name.
Brad Pitt name.
It really is. He could be Dwight Pitt, you know?
Yeah. Sure.
I'm going to send him a message.
Yeah, let him know if he needs to change his brand.
To, yeah.
Or get away from it. If he were checking into a hotel.
Exactly.
He'd and he doesn't want to be known.
Yes.
Dwight Pitt.
He plays Dwight. He is in a relationship with Paula.
Paula.
And his ex-best friend, Ryan, was institutionalized for potentially killing his father and is now back on the streets, seemingly just like back at school. Like we later find out that Brian...
He's often standing behind bushes, ominously. Yeah, also.
100%. Brian is introduced in a way that, like, if you can think about every negative stereotype of someone with mental illness, like... Not even stereotype. Stereotype implies that there's some truth in it. The caricature of someone with a mental illness, it's Brian.
There was a time watching this film where I thought it was perhaps setting us up to stereotype the person with mental illness in order to undercut our assumptions. It did not do that.
But that's exploitation, right?
Sure.
And you know, Dan and I were talking about Under the Skin recently, which Dan watched, and which is a favourite of mine.
It's a very good film. I thought it was genuinely wonderful.
And Dan was talking about the interesting thing about that film is that every choice it makes is, what did you say, the most surprising choice?
Yeah, often it keeps making kind of the most interesting choice it can make at any turn, often. It does wild, especially visually, it does continually wild things in a way in which it clearly wants to just... A film that is not entertaining necessarily, but gives enormous pleasure, and it's interested in making decisions that will give the most pleasure at any point, I think. There are obviously some horrible things in that film as well, but it might perhaps be the most compelling would be a better way to put it.
Sure, and I think that is true of Cutting Class and exploitation too. The thing you say about making the wildest choice, and what leads me to the comment about the mental illness, is that it will make a wild choice, even if that choice is potentially incredibly insulting.
Yeah, that's true. It does not care about... It's not sensitive to anyone.
No, because it doesn't have anything to say about mental illness.
No.
Really. I mean, it accidentally reveals things about what people think people with mental illness are like. But I think if you ask the director, is this how mentally ill people act, he would say no.
No, it's not about that.
No.
I mean, it's an interesting instance of understanding the inextricability of politics and art, because obviously this film has politics, and at times they're more at the surface or less at the surface, but it is not a political project at all.
But
and
it is accidentally a political project.
Yeah, well, even, like, inevitably a political project, perhaps. It has things to say about gender. It ends up... at least inviting the audience to reflect on mental illness, say. It certainly has things to say about the nature of school in the United States.
Sure. So that's the plot in the broadest overview. This is a Brad Pitt podcast, so we should maybe start by talking about Pitt in the film.
Well, let's think about... We had Pitt in The Dark Side of the Sun, who's this kind of boyish incompetent...
He's a fool. He's heinous in Dark Side of the Sun.
It's worth,
because if you didn't listen to the Dark Side of the Sun episode, which, like,
we understand.
That's fine. We get it. He's that's a bad film, and he's the worst person in that film.
Yeah, he's the equivalent of Greg Sestero in The Room. I think Greg might deliver a better performance in the notoriously bad film,
sure,
The Room.
I think Dan and I watched the film together. We were disagreeing while the film was on a little bit.
Mm.
I think Brad Pitt is the best person, the best performance in this film.
Okay.
I think he's really quite good in this film.
I liked him a lot at times.
Sure.
I thought he was, I think, I, yeah, something I said to Joe a few times, he was best when he was not talking. I wonder how much of that is because I had Brad Pitt from The Dark Side of the Sun in my head and I saw some of the same kind of mannerisms and actorly crutches. But I actually think, I mean, they probably didn't shoot this film chronologically, but I actually think he comes into his own over the course of the film.
I think that's definitely true.
You can see this journey from The Dark Side of the Sun, Brad Pitt, who's a little unsure of himself, to a Brad Pitt who becomes incredibly comfortable in his body. And something we both commented on while watching it was the energy of his physicality is something that you still see in him today and is like so present and so distinct. It's what makes him stand out in this movie.
You see, there's a scene where he storms out of a room and he does about 12 things on his way out of the door. Yeah. He like knocks something and kicks something and springs around.
He's interacting with the scenery in a way that he does quite a lot in in general.
He's such an, maybe we said this before, but he's such an embodied actor. He's such a person who like makes a big deal of being a thing in the world.
Yeah.
He's really like constantly, I mean, one of the first times you see him in this film, he's chewing, which of course will go on to be a Pitt staple. That's what I mean
his
about
his first serious scene.
Yeah, he's chewing. You don't even see, you presume it's gum, but not necessarily. It could just be him like pinging and chewing his gum.
But he's chewing very theatrically.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem unbelievable. No. It doesn't seem kind of ornamental or excessive.
No.
It's about him being present in the world in this really powerful way.
Sure. And I do wonder why he's so much more comfortable here than in The Dark Side of the Sun.
I mean, he's not in Croatia.
It's true, in a gimp suit.
Yeah.
I think there's something too. So the character that Pitt plays, Dwight, is a jock. He's an idiot. And when we first start seeing him, he's incredibly horny. Which is, of course, a staple.
I mean, everyone in the film is.
Yeah. Despite it being, you mentioned it's kind of a weirdly sexless film.
Yeah.
There's nudity, there's breasts.
Mm. But it's almost like a cameo, like a nod to the concept of breasts. They don't do anything.
No. And the film is...
You don't even know who they're attached to, actually.
That's true. Yeah. They kind of just pass by the camera.
In a locker room.
Yeah. And Pitt is... Go on, what are you going to say?
So the thought that I had, and it's something that actually might make me view this Brad Pitt with more generosity, is that what if we think about this Brad Pitt in contrast to a film we'll probably watch in, you know, 6 or 7 months, Burn After Reading Brad Pitt, where he plays an idiot with such enthusiasm, he plays a jock with such convincing idiocy. And I think there's something, he knows that this character is supposed to be a dumb jock.
In cutting class.
Yeah. And I think understanding that makes me more likely to appreciate the performance. It's silliness. Because it's a silly performance, I think.
It's also certainly true that, which we were also saying while we were watching Cutting Class, there is a possible world very close to us, very much like us, in which Brad Pitt only played idiots. He played idiot teenage boyfriends who get killed in the first act of a slasher movie for like 10 years, and then he got too old for that, and he was like an army general in the background of a scene.
Yeah.
Stupid people is clearly what the director thinks, that he's a shorthand for a stupid person. Because ultimately, the twist, as always, spoiler alert for Cutting Class,
yeah.
The twist is you are led to strongly believe that Brad Pitt is the killer, and he's not.
Well, the interesting thing is you're led to strongly believe Brad Pitt is the killer by them being so showy about who you think you're supposed to think the killer is.
Sure.
You think, it couldn't be this person. It's a double feint.
Yeah.
Which is, it's a relatively elegant double feint. And I'll tell you what, it got me.
Dan Dixon was, I was like, I was sitting next to someone on a roller coaster. He was having the best time.
I was invested.
It's a really, because I think often I say to Dan, like, I remember quite early in our friendship, we were talking about, I was like, oh, the new Child's Play movie is out. And you were like, I was like, I hear it's really good. And you were like, oh, what, the original? Like, isn't that meant to be just like a dumb doll film? And I was like, Daniel Dixon. And I think
a gradual conversion.
My hope is that this is like your gateway drug.
Sure.
And that you'll be like fucking mainlining Jason Takes Manhattan in like 2 weeks' time.
I wouldn't put it past me. I mean, it's not impossible. I'm open to the possibility.
Absolutely. So yeah, so what happens in the film? The film is
so it opens in the school gym, right?
Yeah. And the film wants you to believe that it's nominally about Paula, that she's the heroine of the film. Because it seems to be like, you know, Brian, who's the weirdo, yeah. who's just been released from an institution, has a crush on her. She has her relationship with Pitt's Dwight, yeah. Brad Pitt. And the film sets you up, I think, to believe that the film will be about her being yeah. torn between these two men.
So you kind of see this triangle visually in the gym scene, and then there's a scene at like outside a diner or a gas station or something where Brad Pitt is flirting with Paula, and you know he goes to buy her a hot dog, but Brian, as Brad Pitt is off buying a hot dog, has already bought her a hot dog,
which is so phallic. It's
there's so much phallic stuff in this movie,
which is interesting because this film presents itself as a horror comedy. It's how it was advertised.
I didn't know that. It is quite funny.
There are some genuinely funny lines, but it's interesting that this film comes a couple of years after Slumber Party Massacre.
Yeah,
which I say with like my glasses pushed down to the end of course. That's Slumber Party Massacre. Yeah. Which was directed by a woman, which is rare for the slasher genre, and is also a horror comedy, which plays very heavily on the joke of phallic imagery. In that film, the killer has a massive drill that he holds between his legs that eventually gets cut off and hypercastric. So it's interesting to me that this film...
it's more subtle than that. Not
much more subtle. And it's a case of the slasher genre being drawn to the same things about itself, like obsessing over itself.
I forgot, actually. Yes. And speaking of that kind of obsession, there is an enormous amount of foreshadowing in this film. And the film doesn't start at the gym, does it? It starts with Paula outside her house with her dad,
sure,
saying he's off on a trip. He's the district attorney, maybe?
Is he?
I think he is. Because wow. So what happens is Paula is with her dad. Her dad is saying, don't have parties while I'm away, et cetera, et cetera. And then he tells her, don't cut class, a line that is returned to later in the film with great elegance. And
are you being mean about
class? No, I enjoy its corniness.
Yeah.
And then her father goes off on a hunting trip in an extraordinary... I saw the father. I didn't think the father was very important because you think, okay, he's just setting Paula up. He's telling her not to do a bunch of things that she will obviously do, and that's how the film will play out. Again, I will say this movie confounded my expectations at several points, to its enormous credit. Father goes, and you see the father on his trip. He goes into a bar where he wants to get information about the hunting ducks or whatever.
Yeah.
And as he enters the bar, the kind of greasy, long-haired man behind the bar says, "Welcome to the kill zone," which is one of maybe like 15 transcendent lines in this film.
Absolutely. So genuinely, I mean, it's worth briefly commenting that this film, its director only made this film, and he is the writer of John Boorman's Excalibur, which is like a very well-regarded take on the Camelot myth. Excalibur is a really good film.
I have not seen it.
Boorman, despite making the worst film ever made, The Exorcist 2, which is, so the joke, right? If The Exorcist is the best film ever made, Exorcist 2 is the worst film ever made. Boorman's like incredibly respected. And so this is a guy who wrote a incredibly respected film for an incredibly respected director and then has gone on to make a film that features the line, "Welcome to the Kill Zone," which is a transcendent line.
It is perfect.
But it's not necessarily a career progression that you'd expect. I think he's still alive.
Huh.
We should send this podcast
to him. We should. We could get him on the next one.
Yeah.
See if he wants to make Cutting Class too.
Dan, I have to add this brief digression because it was the Nobel Prize for Literature was announced yesterday. Oh, yeah. And Dan and I were talking before it got announced about... people who were strongly contested to be Nobel Prize winners for literature. And we were talking about which potential Nobel Prize winners would be most likely to come on the Brad Pitt cast.
The conclusion was Gerald Manane.
He's an Australian
recluse.
He also...
But he comes out for things.
And someone tricked him into recording a cover of Killdozer's Knuckles the Dog, the punk song.
That's right.
I wouldn't want to trick
Gerald Manane. No, we would hate to trick Gerald Manane. He's a man of letters.
I think if we said... to him, like, "Gerald, you know, we think deeply about Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Like, this is a sincere, serious attempt to understand another human being." We could maybe get
it's
him
not
on that.
Likely, but no. It's not out of the realm of it would be easier to get him than Marilyn Robinson, for example. On the
how many potential Nobel Prize winners have watched more than one film starring Brad Pitt? Do you think? Has Margaret Atwood seen...
Yeah, definitely.
Margaret Atwood's seen Star Wars, because she talked about Star Wars as the reason that 9/11 happened.
Oh, that's right. Margaret Atwood... Well, I don't want to go on the record with saying anything about Margaret Atwood. But she is a potential Nobel Prize winner. Murakami. Murakami loves American culture.
True. Maybe Murakami has seen a Brad Pitt film. What about Peter Handke, who did win? He's a fucking fascist.
Allegedly fascist. We don't want Brad Pitt cast to end in getting sued by a Nobel Prize winner.
Peter Handke. Yeah, I guess that's it, right? Faulkner would have liked Pitt. William Faulkner would have fucking loved
that's
Brad Pitt.
That's definitely true. He, in fact, Brad Pitt, I feel like, essentializes a lot of the American themes that Faulkner is interested in.
That's really true. Mm. Has Brad Pitt's never been... I mean, all the cinematic adaptations of Faulkner
have sucked. Didn't Franco do one?
Franco did so many, and they were all absolute horseshit. What the fuck isn't... What, he could be in, like, As I Lay Dying.
Definitely. Oh, he'd be extraordinary with, like, a straw hat.
Damn! We need to write this film.
Get Plan B. Oh, yeah, we could write As I Lay
if
Dying
we get, and, if
with
we,
Brad Pitt in mind.
If we could... If we could trick Brad Pitt to coming on this podcast and then spring our script for As I Lay Dying on him.
Definitely. I'm going to America in January, so maybe if we go to LA, move to...
Yeah.
Sure.
What's the pitch for As I Lay Dying? It's you in a straw hat. Is that all we go for?
I think... Yeah, and
you get to chew a blade of straw.
That's exactly, of course,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and you get some dirt,
and you get calloused hands,
yeah,
and maybe some shears at some point. Some kind of farm. He gets to handle some farm tools.
Yeah, my phone is ringing right now. What's the name? I think it's Bradley J. Pitts. What the fuck are we talking about? You were talking about the dad.
So the dad goes off. He goes, we're back in cutting class. And if we may jump around a bit with cutting class, there is one plot line that I really want to stick to narratively, and it is the dad's journey through this film. He goes off hunting after he's been to this bar. A bar also at which he has a strange interaction with an elderly man who smears worms on him so he will smell. He won't smell like the city, which would repel the ducks, I guess is the point. He goes to this like lake or pond or something in the forest. He is looking at ducks to shoot. You see ducks flying through the air. But ominously, there emerges a bow and arrow.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't see the person wielding the bow and arrow. But I'm pretty sure they say something like, take this district attorney. That's the only reason I think he's the district attorney. I think, definitely. He's the person... And I'll tell you what, I heard that voice and I thought, I think that's Brad Pitt's voice. I think Brad Pitt is going to be the killer. Turns out not the case. Not to be the case.
Successfully duped you.
It bamboozled me. And the dad, Paula's dad, gets shot with the bow and arrow. And you think, well, that's the end of Paula's dad. He clutches at his chest. He falls to the ground. And then we go back to the high school.
Sure.
The most extraordinary trope in this film is that Paula's dad continues to recur throughout the film. Nearly dead, but not quite.
He snaps the arrow in half so it's not like sticking out of his chest.
Yeah.
And then covered in mud, somehow alive. The film must go over like 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
We keep cutting back to the dead, slowly, hilariously trying to get the contact of the police, of anyone coming by.
Yelling help. There's at one point, Brad Pitt's very school goes on an excursion in that particular swamp where the dad is lying still, and one of the teachers steps on him, but no one hears him, no one notices him.
Sure.
It's very funny.
It's great.
He's crying out for help. It is genuinely hilarious, particularly because of the... I mean, that's something else. The actors playing the teachers in the schools in this film are extraordinary.
Yeah,
they're really so good. Something I was thinking while I was watching it is... So you have this kind of cast of teachers at the school. There's the science teacher who is almost kind of like a John Candy, Jonathan Winters style over-actor, but very funny and very convincing. There's the principal who is this coded as queer creep.
Very bizarre. His name's Mr. Dante, and he's coded as queer, but continually pervs on Paula.
That's
like,
true.
Repeatedly asks her to get changed in front of him. But it's so clearly coded as queer.
And none of that's really paid off in the film in any... Like, I guess you're supposed to suspect that maybe he's the killer as well, which I wondered about.
Sure.
But...
Because, I mean, I think you're meant to suspect he's the killer because whether on purpose or accidentally, this to me is a film about queerness and repression. In a way that most slasher films are. Because if you think about the prototype of a slasher film, it's a sexy young couple trying to have sex and being stopped in that act by a kind of outsider, yeah. a mysterious figure.
The kind of disruption of the maturing couple, right?
Sure, exactly. As they're coming into their like sexual blossoming, yeah. there's an outsider. The film explores that most clearly in the friendship between Brad Pitt's character Dwight and Brian, which is coded as being full of repression, like extremely... Definitely. The film kind of picks it up sometimes and then abandons it other times, but it's basically a love story between Dwight and Brian.
Yeah.
And Paula, who, as I say, is nominally set up as the main character, just disappears.
She's barely... She like has no features. Minutes.
No, she's... The film is deeply uninterested in her, which is why it made me think a lot of Friday the 13th, Part 2, Freddy's Revenge, which is a film about a young man who is full of sexual repression. And that involves a scene in which he mentally uses, like, his evil Freddy powers to, like, chain up his gym teacher and strip his gym teacher naked in the shower. Like a sadomasochistic queer ideal. And the director, Jack Shoulder, of that film, claims to have no idea. He now, in retrospect, can be like, I understand. And you would want to be positive about it in retrospect because it's got a cult reputation now. You want to be like, yeah, you know. But he says that at the time, he had no idea.
That's wild.
And I wonder, it made me think, I wonder how... Because there's a scene where Brian and Dwight are talking in this film, deeply euphemistic. They're talking about they were under a car together, doing stuff together.
And yeah, so they position them. I guess Brian is a mechanic, and Dwight is working on Dwight's car, and they reminisce about the time they worked on a car together.
Mm-hmm.
But it very quickly devolves into we don't. That was a long time ago. We don't talk about
Dwight
that anymore.
Dwight literally says we don't talk about that anymore. Which the way he says it, and this is maybe true of Brad Pitt at this era of his career, he's not very good at subtext.
No.
He arguably, it takes a long time actually for Brad Pitt to code much subtext, which is fine for me. I'm a very literal watcher, but like Thelma and Louise, there's no subtext. Everything is being embodied, being a thing in the world. Everything is text. It's entirely text. And Brad Pitt says to Brian something like, he's like, yeah, we don't talk about that anymore. In a way that like, they're definitely talking about giving each other a handjob under the car. Like, no way they're talking about anything else.
Absolutely.
Brian says something about, like, yeah, you hold the screwdriver and it's lefty.
Yeah, righty-tighty, lefty-loosey. And they both have a good laugh.
Yeah, it's wild.
Also, it's something that is only thematically resonant, has no additional narrative impact.
Sure.
Or consequence.
I mean,
their closeness matters,
yeah.
But the sexuality of their closeness just doesn't in any substantial way.
Because the game of the film is, as Dan says, guessing which of the two is the killer, offing the teachers and Paula's dad. Because more and more teachers get killed off in maybe, I think.
Yeah, have we said that? So a bunch of teachers get killed off.
In the film's strongest... Because actually, as you were saying, you said this film is almost PG-13.
Yeah. In the first half, it definitely is.
It's not very violent. Even in the second half, I mean... this might be another way that, like, exploitation cinema, a diet of pure exploitation, fucks with your perceptions. Mm-hmm. But, like, none of this film is particularly bloodless to me. It's particularly bloody.
Mm-hmm.
I watched...
It gets a bit bloodier as it goes along.
But even that is... And this is a perspective thing, I guess. The film never feels particularly mean. Do you agree with that? You're someone who has
I have a very finely tuned mean meat, probably too finely tuned at points. I hate meanness.
I do too, but I love meanness.
I don't think,
I seek it out in films.
I don't want a film being mean to me.
I love a film being mean to me.
I'll have to work through that at some point.
It's my favourite thing.
I wonder what you mean by mean.
I really like films that actively want me to suffer. What is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre but an experience in, like, I'm going to make you feel the most unpleasant things that you could possibly feel? There's no part of you that likes that?
I think I'm interested in the power of that decision.
Mm-hmm.
That seems compelling to me. I think I crave generosity in art. I want art to be generous to its audience. And that doesn't have to mean that it gives you everything, but I want it ultimately to be run through with kindness. I think that's what I look for. And I don't think Cutting Class is mean. I think, here's something that, the thing I like least is when a film thinks its audience is stupid. That's something I can't forgive. And I think perhaps if a film could be mean to you but think you're smart, and that might be okay. I think when I say I don't want a film to be mean to me, I kind of mean I don't want a film to disrespect its audience. And maybe in a film like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, at least you kind of know what you're in for.
But I think for Texas Chainsaw Massacre, intelligence is out of the equation. I mean, a lot of people have written very smart things about Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but that is not a film that wants you to be thinking anything while you're watching it.
I mean, I feel like I've seen, so cards on the table, I have seen a bunch of scenes from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I have not seen the whole thing.
Joe obviously has.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
I was thinking the other day, it might be the film that I've seen most in my life, Texas Chainsaw.
What a surprise.
Because it feels like a traumatizing incident. The experience of watching the film.
Based on what I've seen.
I think it's also interesting at this stage to point out, which is related to this, because I think it's a conversation that will come back, because we'll be talking about movies exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
Dan is Dr. Dan.
Oh, yeah.
And Dan's PhD was basically on relationships through art.
Yeah, the way in which... I'm not going to go too deep into this because you'll find it very boring, but the way in which we attach to authors specifically, so as we might in a social setting. So we feel about authors as we feel about friends, and I think that's obviously... I mean, I do, and I find... I think that it's interesting to think about it that way. And obviously, if I'm understanding art relationships as friendships, I have, you know... Part of my concern will then be about things like kindness and generosity, because that's what you would want for a friendship. You wouldn't want a friend to be mean to you.
And I also bring it up because I think the exercise of examining Brad Pitt is an extension of that.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a social figure, right? And like, we know we're friends with Brad Pitt.
The joy of watching these films of his that I had not seen is the joy of being of seeing your friend in a different social
absolutely.
Context.
Absolutely. Especially, you can either return to a film you've seen and there's a sense of returning to a friend, or, yeah, a friend in a new place.
Yeah, seeing a friend at their job or seeing them with their partner, something you haven't seen before.
Where, in which the new context enriches them. And so that's part of what we hope to get through this podcast.
And which Cutting Class does, I think.
Absolutely,
You see someone... I mean, I'm of the opinion that it's why I love bad acting, and I've mentioned this before. I think when you can see someone not quite successfully landing their lines, you can see a human being. You really feel a closeness.
Which happens several... There's a particular interaction between... is it Brian and Paula, I think? Yeah. That is just really hammy.
Brian and Paula are
they're bad actors, and I think Brad Pitt shines in contrast to them. He doesn't need... them necessarily. I mean, I think he's spotty in this film, but they're just pretty atrocious.
Well, when he's spotty, I think the difference between Cutting Classes and Dark Side of the Sun is that when he's spotty in Dark Side of the Sun, I think you see him approach a challenge and think like, and back away and be like, I don't know how to do this.
That's true.
Whereas in Cutting Class, you see him, the stiffness and spottiness I think you're talking about is you see him note the challenge and then think like, you know what? I'm going to go for it.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm going to go do even more than I thought I was going
to
do.
Which this film is a great vehicle for him to do those things in. I mean, yeah, I don't think we need to go through the whole plot of this film, but just to give a sense of that, the kind of film which Brad Pitt has as his playground.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a wonderful murder scene in which a vice principal who has been kind of is seen as a bit of a, you know, a difficult woman. And has been mean to Brian, been mean to a few of people in the film. She is photocopying in a dark room, is that right?
Yeah.
And she gets her head slammed onto the photocopier by the murderer approaches, slams her head onto the photocopier and kind of obliterates her face. And then you see
each printout of her face being increasingly murdered.
Yeah. Which in one of the... And again... Something that maybe makes this a horror comedy, I don't know how... a very funny scene following that. There is a kind of school meeting where there seem to be a bunch of parents and they're very mad that at this point a couple of teachers have disappeared, this teacher has been murdered, a couple of students have disappeared, presumed dead, and they... Oh, that's right. One of the parents, I think it might even be Dwight, Brad Pitt's dad, is shaking. They're all shaking the photocopy, like the copies of her face. Got
a copy of dead Mrs. Knock
at various phases of death. So from when her face is first slammed on to when there's blood all over it, and they're shaking these photocopies. And one of them says, "Take a look at this. This is a disaster," which is so funny.
It's
there's this wonderful like interplay between understatement and overstatement. The principal. encourages everyone to be calm. And Brad Pitt's dad says, I've written this down. This is why I have these lines. If we stay calm, we'll all be dead. Which, again, is just making literal the kind of the underlying themes of the slasher, right?
Yeah, 100. Because the other thing is, like, there's like 100 people in that room when he says that line. So yeah. Does he think this is the world's most methodical killer? It's just going to be like, right, 8 o'clock on Tuesday, I'm killing Dwight's dad. And then I got to rush because half an hour after that. Like, I guess it speaks to his deep lack of faith in the police force. He just thinks they'll never catch this person. It is interesting, too, to talk about the context of death and sex in high school, which, of course, is like a trope of the slasher. And it's why, for me, it's a thing that I love about the slasher is how deeply Freudian they are. It was something I was going to bring up in terms of the father being an absent figure in this film, like a half-dead figure throughout the film. He's like a totem of the movie. Mm. It's like this constantly recurring, comically inept
zombie-ish
dad. He can't,
and he's like he's filthy, he's crawling, he's staggering,
he genuinely can't even save himself, let alone save his daughter who's in mortal peril.
He's just trying to get back to civilization, and he's often kind of placeless. Like, you see him struggling through a forest calling for help, you're not quite sure where he is.
Which is the Freud thing is, I guess, another point about why slashers are so important to me, because they are such transparent attempts to, they're not attempts to last forever. No. I think very few slasher films are made with the idea of, like, this is austerity, a film that people are going to be watching in 100 years, right? Yeah. They're distinct attempts to capture people's attention on a Friday night for a couple of weeks in August, and then never again. Mm. And so they are blatant about appealing to the very specific time in which they were made, which means that when you look at them back, you see the fears of a time. So when you watch Cutting Class, you see a deep fear of queerness, American queerness. You see a deep fear of the ineffective, absent father. You see a deep fear that, you know, tail end of the 80s, the nuclear family is like falling apart, and that no one can look after anyone but themselves. Yeah,
kids out of control as well.
Yeah, 100%. All these kids getting drunk. Brad Pitt gets extremely unconvincingly drunk later.
It's kind of half gestured towards his, Paul says, have you been drinking?
Yeah.
He says, I can't remember that far back. But then it doesn't really matter.
No. Which ultimately, again, is that, I mean, you know, you were saying while we were watching the film, like, how is the dad still alive after getting an arrow to the chest?
I mean, I ask so many plot questions.
Which the beauty of this film and films like it is, doesn't matter. They don't care.
I think this
No one involved cares, so why should you care?
I think this is, I don't know if I depart that radically from you, because I enjoyed this film. I think maybe part of me just wants a different vocabulary for talking about how I enjoy this film and how I enjoy, I don't know, Casablanca, right? But I don't know if that's just the snob in me.
I definitely felt that way. I definitely felt that films like this were a guilty pleasure. And then this is going to make me sound like a fucking, I don't know, whatever. When I obliterated that boundary between good and a low and high art, my crops were watered, my skin was clear. It was genuinely a transcendent moment for me of being like, I like what I like. Because I was someone, I was a teenager who tortured myself with pretentious films.
Mm.
I really told myself that I love Jean-Luc Godard, and I dragged my poor fucking dad. Of all the terrible things that a son does to his father, maybe nothing is worse than making your father watch fucking, you know, two or three things I know about her at 4 o'clock at the Art Deco cinema. I really thought that that's what you were meant to do if you were smart. If you were smart, you watched Godard. If you were smart, you fucking read War and Peace. And it really gave me a lot of hang-ups.
Yeah.
And I realizing that, like, actually, you can read anything into any work of art. And actually, in some ways, it's really easy to read Godard, because Godard is once, Godard, you know, thinks he's very smart, thinks he's being really smart, and thinks you can just crack his smartness. Whereas Cutting Class doesn't want you to engage with it that way. So when you do engage with that way, it's harder and more interesting.
It is more interesting than Godard, I will give you that.
But, like, so you think this is a worse film than Casablanca?
Yeah, Casablanca's a masterpiece. What are you talking about?
This is way better than Casablanca.
But I guess there's a feeling I get, right? There's a feeling of transcendence I get when I'm watching Casablanca that I don't... I don't think it's just a matter of my snobbishness, which I'm always at risk of being a snob.
I don't think you are a snob.
Oh, thanks, Joe.
I genuinely don't.
I appreciate it. I mean, I think... Well, maybe I'm not at risk of being a snob, because I... Maybe I'm at risk of not paying attention to things because they don't register the cultural symbols that I expect. But I think there is genuinely a feeling of transcendence I get when watching Casablanca that I don't get when watching Cutting Class, and I get a different feeling of transcendence when I'm watching Cutting Class. And I think that's true. I could be wrong about that.
Don't you think, though, I guess, and this was a key in, like, if we watch Cutting Class and we watch Casablanca, so we watch Cutting Class and I said, do you want to watch this film immediately again? Don't you think you would be more likely to say that you want to watch Cutting Class immediately instead of watching Casablanca twice in
a row? I can see that point.
Because I think, you know, I said in the last podcast, I was going to say
I might be more likely to have McDonald's immediately after having McDonald's than a Digar station immediately after having a Digar station.
Do you think Cutting Class is McDonald's?
No, I don't. That was a cheap shot. I think Cutting Class brought me great joy, but I had to overlook things, I think, perhaps, or overlook decisions, overlook bad acting.
But I definitely maybe once had those worries, but now I think, which comes back to the point I was saying about eradicating like high and low art, I think there's bad acting in David Lynch. There's horrendous acting in Twin Peaks The Return.
That's true, but I think Lynch is actually an entry point for me here, because I think often when watching, there's this extraordinary scene in Twin Peaks The Return where a child gets run over by a truck, and there's all these bystanders, and they look like they're in kind of a safety instructional video. It's very strange. Like, this extraordinarily traumatic event has happened, maybe the most traumatic thing in the entire series, and this season at least, and these people are not acting with the requisite horror. All their actions are very deliberate and weird. And I remember thinking when watching that, if I was watching this in a film where I did not know the director, I would think this is a disaster and they've made a mistake. But because it's Lynch, it's not that I assume intention. I just assume that it's part of the vision. And I think there's something about being generous enough to a director that maybe I should be more generous in this way. Just presuming that whatever shows up is part of the vision and is not just because they couldn't be bothered putting the requisite pieces in place, or that they were too stupid to make a better decision.
I guess for me,
it doesn't matter.
I don't care for a single second.
Which might be a better approach.
I get that high wherever I can get it, and I get that high if it's, you know, the guy with the glove at the end of Twin Peaks The Return who's like an objectively...
Oh, I genuinely hate that scene.
I love
that scene. I mean, this is not the Twin Peaks cast.
No, but I think it's matters to Cutting Class, because this is a film... you're saying that you overlook... I don't overlook... I wouldn't trade a single second of this film for any other second.
The other thing I wanted to say is I watch Casablanca and I reflect on my own life
in a way that... You reflect on your life with this? Genuinely, though.
No, I don't think so.
It doesn't... For me, any object that you engage with critically, you're looking at yourself.
Sure.
You're refining taste. You're understanding yourself.
I buy that.
Cutting Class makes me deeply reflect, genuinely.
I'm interested in hearing about how. I'm not being facetious.
Well, I mean... we talk about queerness, right?
Yeah, okay.
This, you know, I'm someone who identifies as queer. Queerness in a high school setting, repression in a high school, repression of queerness in a high school setting is endlessly fascinating to me and makes me reflect on that kind of stuff. I think we're talking about Freud. While we were watching the film, I think about Foucault and about school as prison.
Okay.
All of that stuff is there.
Sure. Toxic masculinity. This film has a lot of stuff about the way in which men use women as objects in order to get what they want.
100%.
Paula in this is essentially like a pawn with these guys like playing out their homoerotic
fantasies. Yeah, and maybe it sounds like when you're watching a film called Cutting Class with like Brad Pitt and where someone gets murdered with a fucking photocopier, someone else gets dragged underneath the bleachers during a gym game and has his throat slit. Maybe it sounds like a reach. But to be honest, I don't really care if it's a reach.
I totally agree. I don't think that matters at all.
Like, you can say whatever the fuck you want to say about any artistic object, and maybe it sounds navel-gazy, but like,
no.
What is criticism if not explaining that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I have not convinced you.
No, yeah, I think you're wrong.
I don't have to convince you.
No, I mean, this would be a boring podcast if we were on the same page all the time. But no, I think I'm definitely more persuaded. I think my hesitation is more a sense that I lack the vocabulary to express why the nature of the transcendent seems different, and also why, like, a slight anxiety that my demarcation of these genres, for example, has to do, because even, like, it doesn't even have to be Casablanca, it can be Blue Velvet, which is also a film with a lot of bad acting, corny high school stuff.
That's an exploitation film.
It shares a line with Cutting Class in which the killer, so in Blue Velvet, Frank turns to Karl McLaughlin's character and says, "You're like me." And the same thing happens when Brian is revealed as the killer and is chasing Paula and Brad Pitt around with an axe. He looks at Brad Pitt and he says, "You're like me, you're a murderer." Yeah. So you have, whereas with Blue Velvet, I would consider it, I think, traditionally a more artistically successful project. It's doing a lot of the same things. Blue Velvet, also a Freud movie.
Do you also think, Tim, I mean, I'm sure this will become a recurring theme throughout the podcast, so we don't need to rest the case now. Do you not also think the joy of watching a film like Cutting, if we had watched Blue Velvet together, we watched it in my house, and I live in a shared house with, and there are other people in the house, and we watched it on the couch, so like my roommates were passing back and forth, would you not feel that a degree of like, not embarrassment.
Sure, I know what you mean.
That Blue Velvet creates an unpleasant air that when people are coming past, there's almost a hostility to
the
air.
Yeah, it feels, yeah.
Because definitely. It feels like you're watching something personal and unpleasant.
That you shouldn't be seeing, which obviously the film is replicating.
Sure.
The same, yeah.
But don't
ideas of voyeurism like that.
Cutting Class, which has more blood than Blue Velvet, the housemate's response is like, Kieran, my housemate, shout out to Kieran, who walked past me watching slasher stuff all the time, he like lets out what is now kind of a distinctive chuckle when he sees what I'm watching.
Sure.
It's a sense of invitation, because these films are so big and so silly, there's a communal sense.
Well, I also think that's true.
We
and
had
I,
fun.
I love,
we
did have fun.
We would not be having fun if it was Blue Velvet, even if it's a masterpiece.
That's absolutely true. Like, yeah, okay. Is what is...
Go on.
Do we want fun from art?
It's a fantastic question.
Does art need to entertain us?
I think, maybe controversially, that the answer to that question is yes.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting take. And I think that's a valid position. I wonder how much of that is just me justifying having sat through a bunch of, like, difficult three... Like,
well, that's
I mean,
the thing,
I love,
right?
Yeah.
What's the fucking film that you were going to see? And I was like, Dan, don't see it. Satan Tango, the
Bellatar
film.
The eight-hour Bellatar film. I want to see that.
You don't
see that. A meditative.
Sure, that film's not like, it's not fucking Cutting Class. That film's fun. If you respond to that film, you're having a degree of fun. You don't think so? You're sitting there.
Satan Tango.
Yeah. Pick the most self-serious.
But also, I think if we were to think about films that deal with very serious and upsetting themes, are they entertaining or are they kind of provocative?
Yeah, I think they're definitely entertaining. They're inviting the entertainment of solving a puzzle.
Well, I wonder. Look, I got to be honest. I'm trying to think of a way to link this back to Brad Pitt. And I think...
We don't... That, Brad Pitt's the
No, I know, I know, I know, I know. But I just, you know, give the people what they want. Or what actually I heard of someone who listened to this podcast and enjoyed it, but wished it wasn't about Brad Pitt, which, you know...
Crushing and beautiful at the same time. Did make me think, like, hey, we've made an error.
Definitely not. Absolutely not. I don't think it's too much of a stretch. And I don't think it's to say that Brad Pitt is an actor who's always fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is something about him, even in his seriousness. And I think so maybe if we're thinking about all movies being fun, I think they're in... All successful movies being fun, of course. There is something about seeing, for example, a person with extraordinary presence and extraordinary charisma on screen in a new context, perhaps, or an interesting context, or the world acting on them in a particular way, that always has this element of like titillation and excitement and fun, even if the themes being dealt with are very serious.
Well, I mean, a specific Pitt example of that is 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah,
right?
Which I actually haven't seen. Okay. I'll see it. But yeah.
Extremely hard to watch film, like really hard to watch. I think, and Brad Pitt shows up kind of at the end. That still has to be an entertaining and fun object.
Yeah.
You still have to enjoy, and maybe you're crushed but you're not actually crushed. Like, no one in your family has died. It's a different kind of feeling.
True. Crushed. There's a vicariousness.
Yeah.
In cinema, automatically.
Which, of course, relates back to Cutting Class. It does. The film that we're doing. No. I think we've blasted through most of the plot, really.
Well, let's talk about the last scene. Yeah. Because I think it's interesting. Oh, there was something I wanted to say about... Actually, did I say this already? The way in which... I started talking about how the teachers were all so great.
Mm.
But specifically, when I was a kid, I used to watch American high school films with teachers in them and think, oh, these... It must suck to play just the bad guy. Like these kind of curmudgeonly, difficult, boring people, straight-laced people. But looking at it now, it seems like the most fun you could possibly have as an actor. And all the teachers are having so much fun. So I wanted to return to that because there are just a number of, I think the teachers are actually, along with Brad Pitt, the standouts in this film. And I don't know if this is a recommendation podcast, I would definitely recommend this film for the kind of way in which it plays out these high school relationships and like the teachers and students and these scenarios are they're a lot of fun.
Sure. I hope I'm not telling tales out of school here, but Dan told me recently that It's a Mad, 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 Mad World was like a formative film for me.
Absolutely.
Are you talking a little bit about It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World here? Like, is the stuff that you respond to, do you think you respond to the characters, the teachers in this film, because they're quite, it's a mad, 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 mad world?
Well, I think I mentioned earlier that one of the science teachers, like Jonathan Winters, right, who's in a mad, 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 we'll just say a mad world. I think there's a zaniness to it. There's a kind of ensemble performativity that I really enjoy. Sure. I watched that dozens of times as a child. It's just, you know, one of those films that your parents happen to have taped at some point, so it becomes arbitrarily an essential part of your character.
And you kind of assume that everyone else in the world has as much of a shorthand for it. It's a mad, mad, mad world.
I can quote that film extensively, and I do with my parents often. That's astonishing. It's very funny.
But it's a mad, mad, mad... I kind of want to say it the full time every time. They feel quite similar to Cutting Class.
Yeah, I buy that.
A sense of circus. Sure. What's it? Oh, it's a mad, 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 mad world, if not an attempt to just make you like laugh constantly.
Yeah, it's almost a sketch show.
Yeah.
Which maybe Cutting Class is as well in some ways. Cutting Class is like a series of vignettes.
A string of set pieces stuck together.
Well, I do want to talk about the final set piece.
Go on.
Because it's quite funny. So there's this... Brian is revealed as the murderer. Paula is like running around the school.
Which, as Dan says, you think the film is going to be sensitive about mental illness and like Brian has been
unfairly maligned.
No, he starts talking about, I want to kill people in the future.
Yeah.
I'm going to like break new ground in killing.
He's deluded. And also not only do you, the audience think he's the killer, but at this point in the film, Brad Pitt has accused him of being the killer. The cops are after him. So the world is against him and he feels hard done by despite the fact that he actually is the killer. And he's revealed when he's left a problem on the blackboard in which the maths teacher and Paula, who are trapped in the school together, have to solve the problem and work out how to get out of the classroom, which is a very funny set piece that makes no logical sense. Insane. When you drill down to it. It's totally wild. Again, one of those things that felt like it was written in about 15 seconds and no one bothered to... Like, the maths problem does not make sense. I'm not going to go into why, but it's absurd. And so they think... Also, not only does it not make sense, but the maths teacher is sure that he solved the puzzle and has the right door. He steps out into the corridor. I was like, I've got it. And then he's greeted with an axe in his head from Brian. Brian starts raving at Paula about this, his dreams of killing.
Which the first time, I don't know if you've seen this film. I don't know if you had this experience. When I first saw this film, I thought it was maybe going to go sci-fi. When he's talking like, I will teach you how to kill in the past and kill in the future. I was like,
yeah,
but that's going to be a fucking time travel
movie. Some of the dialogue in this film really seems suggestive in ways that are just not important. Turn out not to be important.
No.
It's very strange. And then our hero... Brad Pitt bursts through the door of the science classroom or whatever.
In the moment that you realize that he's definitely a good guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Which you were led to suspect that maybe, it's the double
thing. I was sure that Brad Pitt was the killer.
Sure, because he seemed so clean cut and Brian seemed so like completely deranged.
It's like, the film can't be doing this to us, but in fact it is, which is a wonderful double bluff.
It's a good trick, right? Yeah, it is. To make you think that you're smarter than the film and be like, you're not smarter than me at all.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And then... Brad Pitt it's been foreshadowed earlier in a really funny scene. Oh, I wrote this down as well because I was obsessed with it. In a scene in the science classroom early on in the film where the... Is it magnesium? It comes into contact with water and it causes an explosion.
Sodium,
sorry, yeah. We did that in high school. I think it is magnesium.
Maybe is it magnesium burns very bright, but maybe I think he's true. Talking maybe about sodium chloride.
Sodium chloride, sorry.
And he's got a big old thing of sodium.
That's right.
Yeah. To be honest, I don't know that because I know science. I know that because I've seen cutting class so many times. Just terrifying.
But in the scene in which it's foreshadowed, in which the science teacher is explaining this reaction, he says, the science teacher says, "So minerals is a world of great complexity and fascination," which I just wanted to relay because it's another genuinely transcendent moment in this film. What a line. But Brad Pitt thinks he has the correct chemical to throw in the water to blow up Brian. And in fact, he throws the rock at Brian after wetting the ground as they've been running away from him. And nothing happens. And Brian says, "You shouldn't have come to class late. That was just a rock." Which is very funny.
And then we have a showdown in the shop, in the hardware shop, like with all these drills and machines. You have a fight with two guys with extremely phallic like belt sanders.
And there's a buttons are pressed which seem to just automatically set off all the machines and create atmosphere with smoke flying everywhere. Yeah,
it's very important that every hardware shop at a high school has that.
Exactly. And Paula and Brad are in combat with Brian.
How does Brian get dispatched?
Well, Paula says, "Close your eyes."
Oh, yeah. Because he's
Brian puts Paula in like a vice. Brian puts Brad Dwight in a vice. And as Brad is stuck in the vice, Paula says to Brian, "Let him go. I'll do anything you want," because Brian nominally wants to date Paula, I guess,
which
isn't really
doesn't.
The end game.
No,
yeah,
he wants
he's into
to date
Brad
Pitt.
Yeah, yeah, it's a sublimation or whatever Freud would call it. So Paula says, like, tries to convince him that she is actually into him and says, "Close your eyes. I would never hurt you." And then hits him in the head with a hammer when he, in fact, concedes and closes his eyes, which is, again, unlikely. I mean, I guess we've learned that Brian is not the most stable. That's all right. Two things. Brian tries to get Brad Pitt to kill Paula. And he says, "If you kill Paula, I won't hurt you. I promise, one bro to another," which again...
Themes of the film.
Undertones.
It's cohesive as a thematic object.
And then before Paula strikes him in the head with the hammer, she says, maybe it's after he's got the hammer in the skull. She says, "No more fucking around with my emotions."
Yeah.
And there are a lot of good lines in this
Ben's
film.
Ben's face and body language implies that he has had a better time in this film than he's admitting.
I had a good time. You should see me after Casablanca. Fucking
bad
ecstatic.
Casablanca.
It's genuinely a perfect movie.
It's such a boring film. I'm sorry, Dad.
That's
what the who the fuck cares? They're friends at the end.
That's lovely. No, they'll always have Paris.
No, I don't care if they have Paris.
Oh, he gave it anyway. Well, we don't need to get into Casablanca.
We can
now.
Do the Casablanca book.
We watch Casablanca a bunch of times, and I try to convince you that it's good, and you try to convince me that it's bad. If you are interested in us changing franchises, email the bradpittcast@gmail.com.
We could change the Gmail name. You can't.
That's
actually,
true.
Can you?
We could do a redirect to the Casablanca cast. Podcast of Blanca. The final scene is worth relaying as
it
well, because it's
is.
Again transcendent.
Brad Pitt and Paula are driving off, being just let go by the cops after this incredibly traumatic.
Yeah,
for some reason,
like,
the cops are just like, "Off you go.
Yeah,
drive her home now.
You murdered him on a belt sander or whatever,
yeah.
But that's cool. He probably deserved
it. We won't provide
it.
You with any counseling or anything."
No.
And they're driving off, and the dad has finally made his way back to the civilization.
You see this extraordinary hero shot of him coming to the top of a mountain,
looking bedraggled, half
yeah.
dead, stumbling down the hill.
And Brad Pitt and Paula are driving in this car at the like along the base of the hill, and start to see her father just tumbling down, and they're like, "What's that?"
I suppose I said before I wouldn't change a frame of Cutting Class. I'd kind of like it if Brad Pitt and Paula ran over a dad.
Yeah.
If the ending of the plot is like him desperately getting back, and then he gets run over by them.
See, I think I kind of wanted that to happen in the moment, but I think I'm glad it turns out the way
sure.
it does, because it turns out it's kind of been foreshadowed earlier that there's been talk of cutting brakes of cars like a couple times. Oh, that's right, because he tightened his Yeah. When he was as the mechanic under the car, Brian obviously cut Brad Pitt's brakes. Although he somehow got the car from the mechanics and back to his house. Anyway, not important.
Damn, it's these questions didn't matter. Nobody cared about this. Why should you care about it?
I'm going to go on the IMDb goofs and like
spend the next six hours adding,
putting in all the mistakes in cutting class, tearing that film apart, and then the father like rises up like Lazarus and stumbles over to the car and is like, "Why aren't you in school? You better not be cutting class."
Freeze frame.
Brad Pitt.
Look at the smile on your face. How is that different from the smile you get at the end of Casablanca?
It's not as powerfully resonant with kind of the stuff of life.
I have a strong suspicion that you'll think about this film more than you've thought about Casablanca.
I've seen Casablanca 4 or 5 times.
But when does Casablanca come to your life?
Occasionally.
When?
When I see two. I actually, you know, maybe this is why subconsciously it came to mind. As after the kind of the saw incident or whatever, when in the industrial, I guess it's a design and technology class or whatever.
Yeah.
But this room is filled with things that can murder you, where Brian eventually meets his demise. And as Brad Pitt and Paula are walking off into the distance, I think I did say they'll always have Paris.
Yeah. This is my on your mind.
Yeah.
And maybe this should be the place where you leave this argument for now. That's not my way of like trying to get the last word
over. No, it's fine, please.
Dan and I have actually watched quite a lot of films together.
Yeah.
And a lot of my very favourite films, which like I don't just like trash. I mostly like trash.
No, not at all. And I wouldn't even call it trash. No. I think you have a respectable taste.
But like Dan and I watched Safe, the Todd Haynes film together, which is like top 5 film for me. We watched Sweet Smell of Success, which
fantastic movie.
Any day I'd usually say is like my second favourite film. Mm. We walked out of those films buoyant, but were we as giddy with happiness as we are after cutting class? And in a difficult, painful world, is that not a genuine respite? That's not a cheap thrill.
Yeah. No, it's not. No,
there's stuff to talk about.
Her father tumbling down the hill. I was so happy to see that.
Genuine happiness.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes they genuinely
hard to come by.
Sometimes I genuinely think critics like Roger Ebert, who are extremely rude about the artists who matter most to me, people like John Waters and people like Sean S. Cunningham, who made the Friday the 13th film. Sometimes I genuinely wonder, is the problem that they just don't know how to allow themselves to have pleasure?
Yeah.
How is this film is constructed to make you happy? It's not long. It makes no demand on your time. You have a great time. You have stuff to think about. It's not treated you like an idiot. It's got thematic subtext. Great film. I should probably say at this point, if you found me insufferable when I was talking about films I didn't like, wait until you fucking hear me talk about films I do like. I'm way worse. I'm way harder to put up with.
You've got to find some mediocre films.
What do you... God, we've got some mediocre
films. We do have some mediocre ones coming up. That will be... we'll have to find things a lot apart from Brad Pitt to keep us occupied.
What would you give this film in a 5-star?
See, it's interesting because, look, we actually, I think we didn't do that. We did this with Ad Astra. I don't think we did this with...
Did we not? No, maybe we just did it back
with
and
the Dark Side of the Sun. I would say, I think Dark Side of the Sun 1 star for both of us, right? Not half a star.
I think I gave it 1.5 stars in my Letterboxd.
Okay, I would give it 1 star.
Okay. There was
the motorcycle race. Anyway,
it's such a deranged vision, Dark Side of the Sun.
I'm still not recommending it to anyone. I can imagine it wasn't cruel.
No.
So maybe, I mean, I'm... It was very boring. It did demand a lot of me. I think I'll say 1 star.
Okay.
This... Cool. I mean, you're not going to like this.
What are you going to say?
My heart says 3.5.
That's all right.
Okay.
I thought you were going to be real mean.
No, no, no.
To be fair, if I was giving a star rating, I'd only say 4 stars.
Okay.
Like, I've seen...
I mean, we're 0.5 star apart. We're not Margaret and Daviding here.
I've seen my letterbox says that I've watched about, like, 600 slasher films. I would maybe put this at, like... 400 and something.
Okay.
I like it quite a deal less.
You really like slasher films?
Damn, they're the best.
I gotta watch some more of these.
Yeah. Do you think that you would?
Yeah, absolutely.
If we had a free day and I was like, you had just watched Cutting Class and I was like, let's watch four more of these.
I don't think I've ever watched 5 films in a day in my life.
Okay. I'm just trying to test.
I'd watch 2 more.
Is that because you're a very polite person? Is it, would it be out of politeness?
No. I think I would genuinely. I mean, it depends on the day, and it depends if we've got food, and depends on the length of the films. If they're 2-2.5 hour films, I'm probably going to struggle. But 2-90 minute films, absolutely.
No American slasher film is 2.5 hours long.
As someone who finds 2.5 hour films, to be honest, unnecessary. Rude. Yeah. I would have
said that with such sincerity. They are rude.
Yeah.
Why the fuck do you want to see Satan Tango then?
I mean, it's sometimes. I was recently in a class where some students were complaining about lectures, and I said sometimes in life it's important to just sit and have to listen to something when you don't want to do it. And maybe I feel like
that should not be the case with art, Dan. We're dying. There's no life after death. Life is torture and difficult.
So is Satin Tango, I imagine.
Yeah, allow yourself some pleasure. I mean, film.
I'll interchange it with some cutting class.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm giving, and I have to say, obviously, I enjoyed this film. Obviously, I would recommend it to people.
If you had to order the three films, we won't do this very film because will be a lot.
The clearest vision is Cutting Class. The most successful film is Cutting Class.
Cutting Class and Astro, Dark Side of the Sun. That's my ranking too.
Yeah, and it's as wide a spectrum as one could imagine, I think. That's like true. From A to C. But yeah, it's and look, I mean, if some Brad Pitt fans download this podcast and hear us, I mean, I guess they're all
Brad Pitt fans are listening.
I mean, who else is? But maybe they'll be mad at the mistreatment of Ad Astra. But I genuinely think this is certainly a more successful film than Ad Astra. Ad Astra sets up a bunch of things that it clearly takes very seriously that it doesn't deliver on. The things that Cutting Class sets up that it doesn't deliver on, it obviously doesn't care about. It's just having fun. I'm so heartened
to hear you say that. It's really, truly like poetry to me.
I enjoy this movie. I agree. I'd 7 out of 10 for 3.5 stars. Go on. Check out Cutting Class. Order the Blu-ray. Oh, we should say as well, the reason we didn't have an episode last week is because we had ordered the Blu-ray of Cutting Class and it took too long to arrive.
Which I don't... The Blu-ray came from Vinegar Syndrome, who are like one of my favourite. They do a lot of great preservation of exploitation
films. Sponsor the podcast.
Fucking Vinegar Syndrome. I bought Cutting Class. I bought Don Dola's Night Beast, which is a 5-star film. We'll make Dan watch that one. And I bought Andy Milligan's Flesh Pot on 42nd Street.
I haven't heard of any of these films. I hadn't heard of Cutting Class if I wasn't doing a Brad Pitt.
They're great podcast. Films. Vinegar Syndrome, fucking send an email. Brad Pitt cast at you. We'll just whatever. We'll do. The we'll Brad ultimate Pitt. The Brad
yeah.
Pitt.
Yeah, I couldn't get Brad Pitt cast. Someone had it.
Did they really?
Honestly, yeah. I tried Brad Pitt cast at Gmail.com. Oh, shit. Didn't. Yeah, it wasn't available.
Oh, shit.
So we got some competition. Very
stiff competition. Thank you all so much for listening. We will definitely be in your ears in a week's time.
Absolutely.
Because the next film is Across the Tracks. Which is a freely available on YouTube in a pretty good rip.
Great.
Spanish subtitles.
But, that's all right.
You take what you can get. Have you seen Across the Tracks before?
What do you think? No, I haven't.
Spoiler alert. It's going to be a rough time.
Okay.
So you get the less insufferable joke.
All right.
Next time.
Excellent. No, I enjoyed this.
Yeah. We had a great time.
Wonderful time. We got to watch Cutting Class.
We got to go. And then tonight we're going off to see John Waters' Serial Mom together. Which is another fucking 5-star
film. I've never seen it. Oh. Joe's changing my life.
It's wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll speak to you next week.
Until next time.
Until next time.